Healthcare reform. Today is February 26th. We are going to continue with our informational meeting format with the guest facilitator, Dr. Goldberg. Before we get going, I have a couple of announcements. The first is in the good news, bad news category. As many of you may have noticed, Representative Greenlich is much more ambulatory, so we're happy for your help, but does this mean you're going to visit me in my office now?
Not until the braces are off.
Yeah, we're all concerned about that. And the second is, this evening, I think this is a general concern for all of us. I think this committee has made significant progress, and yet we don't have anything from LC yet. And I think, as we can all appreciate, they've been really quite busy and will obviously remain very busy through the rest of the session, but they've been particularly busy up through today. So after today, we are going to sit down and take what we have produced so far and reduce that to legislative language that we can get back to the committee for their critique and review. I also have distributed to all of your places a one sheet page that has what we are discussing, so we can just kind of go down this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with regard to the entity and what its function will be with regard to the topic of the evening, which is obviously access and eligibility. So with that, unless there's anything for the good of the order, let me turn it over to our facilitator extraordinaire, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you, Senator Westland. And
just a second, do
you have anything to say? Not much more. And you should know that I think Senator Cruz will probably be gone for another day or two. He's actually pretty ill and just kind of getting through this thing. And I appreciate the other members coming. We've got people sick and bad weather and all kinds of stuff going on, so I appreciate seeing everybody here. And Senator Morris, I'm glad to see you back on your feet and back here with us, too.
I need to report, Senator, that Senator Cruz, on the record, in our health committee, was whining about the fact that you couldn't cure him instantly.
Well, if he quit smoking, we might get a little faster response here.
Okay. I
saw him. I mean, we've already broken every HIPAA thing we can do with here, so, he's got a bad, he has a bad bronchitis.
Well, we wish him well.
Yes.
Representative Cannon had a class this evening. So he sends his regrets and apologies.
I thought he was out of school. He's that young, isn't he?
He always keeps learning.
Dr. Goldberg.
Okay. Senator Wessel started off with, I think, a good perspective as to where all this is going, that as we speak every night, this is really about being able to take the thoughts and the proceedings and the ideas that are generated and being able to turn those into some more concrete language around the bill that can then come back and be discussed, vetted, and modified as need be. And we've made actually some significant progress. We started off and I think have come to some consensus about an entity that needs to provide some oversight and regulation and design, and we've talked about some of that overall and general function and came to some consensus about that. Last session, we began to talk about benefits and really framed the discussion, much as we'll frame the discussion tonight, around how you as a legislative body would like to direct that entity to consider and think about benefits. What are the issues that you want this group to consider? What are the parameters? How do you want this entity to go about and define what a benefit package is? Great discussion. Tonight, we're going to switch to access and eligibility. And once again, to think about this in terms of not talking about exactly who will be eligible and who will have access and what access is, but to really frame this as you have an oversight group and a design group, and what instructions do you want to give them? How do you want them to think about this? What are the issues you want them to consider? And what sort of product will you be looking for? We've done a little homework. And rather than sort of brainstorming ideas, what you have before you, and I think members of the audience have them as well, is a piece of paper that says, Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform, Access and Eligibility, 226-2007. And then there are directions to the entity. And what this really is now what we can do is go down sort of 1 through 28, if we get to 28, and really begin to talk about what you would like to instruct the entity to consider, deliberate about, and in what context you want them to make some of these decisions. So let's start with number one, if that's okay, which is defining eligibility for this program for healthcare in the state. How would you like them to define eligibility?
I thought tonight we're going to try to focus just on eligibility. Some of these issues here are way past eligibility, but eligibility itself has some real need for serious conversation here. So are we going to focus on eligibility and then see how far we get? Is that your plan?
Yeah. And if we can move on to some of the access issues, and we don't have to take these in order.
Okay.
But we are leading with defining eligibility.
Okay.
So,
yeah. The big things I would look at in this is what your residence requirement is, how long you have to be in the state, and then you've got to start thinking about people moving here because of pre-existing conditions, how you deal with that. And you always have to talk about, whether you like it or not, illegal immigrants in the state. Those are for me the major issues to deal with.
Sounds great. The pre-resident.
Pre-existing conditions,
residency,
and
you were talking about citizenship?
Citizenship.
And the residency issue you really were framing as state residency.
Correct.
So you want them to really think about this as if we create a program, and let's actually start with residency and sort of flush that out for a second. So.
Well,
what is it you want to see
around
that?
I think the discussion here is about two things in residency. One, first, is just an understanding. In the Medicaid part of the program, by federal law, there's no limit on residency. If you enter the state today, you're a resident tomorrow.
That's correct.
The problem is people come in out of the state just to get into the Oregon Health Plan or whatever you want to call it. Okay, and there's probably not a lot you can do about that. But the second part is more important. That's how long do you have to be in the state as a bona fide resident before you're allowed to be on the plan?
So
that starts out sounding pretty simple, but it really isn't.
So you want to assure somehow that people don't flock into Oregon just for this.
But at the same time, you'll have people moving here for work. They've got a job waiting for them, or there's a great job here. And, you know, you make them wait a year. You make them wait 90 days. What if they want to come here, but their employer says, I can't get you health care because it's Oregon. You have to wait a year. What kind of things do you have in place to answer those questions? And that's what we have to have a discussion about. We discussed this at length in the interim, and I think some pretty innovative ideas came out, but I'd like to hear what other people have to think about this first.
Well, those are two great thoughts. How do we assure that people, this is a program that is for Oregonians, but yet how do you balance out that need that people who move here, you want to be certain can get immediate access? Can be immediately eligible?
Potentially.
Okay.
Or within 90 days, which is the norm. I mean, I have thoughts on how to do it, but I'd like to hear what other people think.
Representative Greenlink and Senator Biggs. Senator Westland. Confusing you two, that's trouble.
That's getting way too often.
I know.
There's only one of them that has hair.
That answer's been offered before also way too often.
To a certain extent, it's kind of a moot question, I think. I mean, if you can't put a residency requirement on any part that's partially subsidized by Medicaid, and the rest is paid for something, I'm assuming something like a payroll tax or something very specific, why would you want to care about a residency requirement?
The concern I have is that people with significant pre-existing conditions would move this, who don't have insurance where they're at, would move here strictly for that reason. I think you could have a real possibility of that happening, because it's not a national program, it's a state program we're looking at.
But if they're under Medicaid, you can't restrict them.
I mean, other than Medicaid recipients, outside of Medicaid recipients. That's why I sort of bifurcated this thing. The question about Medicaid settled. They're immediately eligible. But everybody else is still, what do you want to do to that population? You want a good program? You want it reasonable for people coming in. You know, when we discussed this, we found out if you work for certain companies, you have to wait a year. Some companies, 2 years to get your insurance. Others, 90 days.
So one common way of doing this is a waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done for exactly that reason.
Why are we excluding Medicaid with a waiting period?
Under federal law, you have to.
But there are possibilities of requesting waivers.
We could,
although I would say it's unlikely, because it's actually a constitutional
issue
around.
Is it the equal protection
benefits, such that as a U.S. citizen, you are, when it comes to federal benefits, you need to be able to transfer from one state to the next. It's actually a federal program, not a state-only program.
I would suggest that if we're dealing with health care reform in the larger context, then that needs to be on the table. I'm not suggesting that you have.
We could have an amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Well, no, I'm thinking, you know, if the federal government is not going to deal with this issue and tell us that this, or tell states that you need to deal with it, then at some point the federal government's going to have to deal with what the states decide. And so this is something that clearly at least needs to be discussed. And it's about putting the pressure back on the federal government to come to the table and engage in the debate. It's not about what the ultimate answer is.
Let me see if I can reframe it.
Good question.
Which is what you're saying is, you heard what all of us said, you can't do it, but you'd like to tell the board, this entity, to actually carefully consider this, go out, get some legal expertise, talk to the federal government, and see if you can be creative about getting around this.
Right. I don't know what the answer ultimately is, but I mean, without the federal government engaging in this debate, then I think we may not be as successful as we want to be.
Great. Senator Morse.
Specific. Think in terms of 6 to 12 months waiting period.
Excuse me. Could somebody turn that off? Throw the bag out of the room.
You learn a lot about a person by their cell phone.
I thought you were taking exception with what I was saying.
Senator Morse.
Okay. Think in terms of a 6 to 12 months, some in that range of waiting period, with an exception process for employers to petition for immediate coverage. When you bring, you know, if you have a physician comes into your clinic as an employee,
yeah.
Do you want them to have to wait in the same way? And I don't think so.
No.
I think if they have a job and they're employed and their employers want to petition, then they should be allowed to do so.
Could you think of that as a buy-up the employer could do? That would be one of the buy-ups they could do? If the normal is a 6-month or a 12-month waiting period, I mean, for my particular office, we have immediate eligibility. It's one of our buy-ups. You know, it would cost me a little more money to do that, obviously. Would that be something of handling that? It would be
one way of looking at it.
The employer could buy up for that?
So you might think about exceptions to a waiting period that had to do with employment, some change in family status, someone needed to come to the state to take care of their ailing sibling or parent, et cetera. There might be a series of exceptions you could work out.
By an application process, not automatically.
And a buy-up or contribution. But, you know, I don't think you have to get completely hung up on this. It's just we're looking at directions to the board. We don't have to solve it. We don't have to dot every I.
So one idea was a waiting period and then developing exceptions, trying to be creative about a federal waiting period. What other things other than a waiting period?
You could still utilize OMIP as a buy-up for pre-existing conditions. The individual could buy an OMIP, or it could be a buy-up by the company, the employer.
Senator, are you suggesting that pre-existing conditions are going to have a different standard? Because when you are hired by an employer, and you're brought into their group plan, they bought you. I mean, there is no wait time on pre-existing conditions.
Actually, my knowledge of it is that it depends on the policy. In many policies, even if you tell me what policy employers bought, have a wait period for pre-existing conditions and will insure the patient, but not for that pre-existing condition for 6 months or a year, or it varies some.
If you bring a certificate if you were insured previously from your past employer, then those waivers.
I'm talking about people coming into a program that have not been previously insured, and they'll often send you a letter saying, do you have any, as a physician, have you been treating this patient for this condition prior to the time the insurance took place? And if they do, they're gonna say we won't cover that condition because they didn't have insurance during that time.
But I think the issue here trying to get at is seems like not how to someone who's here for a job with an employer, not how to keep that person out. It's really about those people who might come to Oregon who don't have some sort of employment and who have some catastrophic pre-existing condition.
Yeah, that's
really the issue.
That's the crux of, I think, what we're trying to get. I mean, we're trying to put an awfully fine point on who's eligible, who's not. I mean, that's one, category that the entity is going to have to, sharpen that point.
So you want them to consider pre-existing conditions. You want them to figure out how to have this be for Oregonians. What about the issue of those individuals who are U.S. citizens or not U.S. citizens? Very controversial political topic.
It'd be nice.
No one wants to touch it.
Senator Morse, then. Actually, Senator Mona Anderson.
Yes.
I think that we need to understand, which I don't know, what services are already covered by Cowan. And they obviously will be seen in the emergency room anyway. And it would be nice for this committee to figure out what is more expensive, covering them or letting them be seen in the emergency room.
But they're seen in federally qualifying health clinics today.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets back to the integration with the federal government when you have laws like EMTALA, which I don't know what the acronym is, but emergency something or other,
yeah.
The requirement that we see everybody in the emergency room. I mean, if you can't close that gate, or at least partially close that gate, and at least divert people to a less expensive mode of entry point, then we're not going anywhere. You know, I don't think there's any physician that's not going to treat anybody during an emergency. But we have got to deal with closing that gate.
But they need to...
It's just prenatal and childbirth for Kellum right now. I mean, that's three quarters of it, isn't it?
Those are where most of the expenses are. It's a list of conditions that actually the federal government puts out. The vast majority of the expenditures are childbirth,
mm-hmm.
but it's for emergency and catastrophic care.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Bates.
I think Representative Myers and Representative Richland have this thing right. This entity should be directed to strengthen the safety net clinics as much as possible to deal with this problem. But I think just opening it up to total eligibility is a mistake. You don't want them going to the emergency rooms. They're going to be treated anyway. You're absolutely correct. But directing them and strengthening the safety net clinics is probably the best way of dealing with this problem. At the present time, we still have cases. I mean, we've got a case in Ontario right now of a woman who's been there from the hospital for months, and they're trying to get her well enough to get her back to Mexico. The bill's over $1 million, and the hospital's going to have to deal with that bill. So it's a real tough deal, but that's a real thing. Another point too, Representative Maurer, I think, is right about something else in the previous context. The confusion about what is pre-existing and not pre-existing, what different insurers have and don't have, and the difference in policies, what they don't agree, I guess I'll stop, but leads me to think that an entity like this can simplify the administrative part of this by making things clear and common across policies in those kind of areas. So we're all dealing with the same level playing field. I think you're right about that. You know, you and I can sit here and talk, and we're not too sure ourselves, and we're both in the business, what's covered and not covered sometimes, what's pre-existing and not pre-existing, and who's in and who's out. And an entity like this can really help clarify that and make the administration of the system a lot simpler. So I think you're absolutely correct on that.
Representative Greenland.
Yeah, this conversation continues to perplex me a little bit because things seem based on a model of where we are now, not on a model of where we're going. For example, why would we have an OMIP program when we have the Universal Access Program? OMIP is to provide health insurance for people who can't buy health insurance in the individual market, and it's a way of subsidizing those people by charging other insurance companies the premium on their care. So it doesn't seem to me if we have a universal access system that OMIP's there anymore because everybody has access to health care. One way or the other. The same issues around pre-existing conditions. I mean, it seems to me somebody comes to Oregon and goes to work, they become a part of the healthcare system. And the fact that they came here with high blood pressure, okay, they came here with high blood pressure. I mean, some of this eligibility question is odd. I mean, the answer, who's eligible? Everybody. That's what we have universal access for. Okay, you want to say everybody who's a legal resident, although there's no such thing exactly as a legal resident. Everybody who's not an illegal alien. I mean, but if we're talking about universal, the eligibility question is easy. It's everybody, isn't it? Is there something that I'm missing in the term universal?
Well, but hold on. I think that would be an appropriate way of thinking about universal. I don't think that was really the question. I think the question was, given that it is universal, how would you, for instance, would you have any check and balance in the system so that an individual who had a serious medical condition that lived in another state couldn't afford health insurance that they would move here for that?
So they would, you know. I mean, basically speaking, there isn't really much evidence that this kind of stuff happens very often. And most of the people who might show up might be people we would be very happy to have here. Or they would be so poor that they're going to be eligible under under an expanded Medicaid. I mean, it just strikes me as being... I think when we're thinking about this, we need to think about what the system might look like, not what we're doing right now if we just did something in the short term. Although I think we need to think about that too, but that's a different...
Okay, let's go to Senator Westland, Representative Richardson, and Senator Bates.
Yeah,
and Senator Morse in the middle in there somewhere.
I appreciate Mitch's comments. And again, basic premise here. I mean, you know, these are instructions we're suggesting to the entity. And with regard to the citizenship issue, I mean, first fact. Undocumented workers are here today, and they're impacting the medical system. They are here. So maybe the recommendation of the entity should be to construct a modeling that would, to the best extent possible, you know, prevent or reduce cost shift. That's, you know, we're incurring these costs today, but what would the vision, what's over the horizon? How could we address that issue? So I think you need to put the cost shift component into that discussion. And then with regard to OMIP, what I heard Senator Bates saying is, I don't think that's OMIP as it currently exists, but it could be an administrative placeholder, if you will, a place, you know, to park some additional funds if there were some of these people, big time executive, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on, that want to come here, you know, a mechanism, you know, to accommodate some, you know, unique circumstances. I agree with your universality comment, Mitch, but I think there needs to be in the recommendation of the entity, you know, some safety valve, if you will.
Representative Richardson.
I agree that there needs to be a safety valve, and I think OMIP is that safety valve, and we need to realize that when we're looking at pre-existing conditions, if we do not provide a place for them to go, then every underwriter is going to be padding the premiums to assure that if they get hit unexpectedly with a couple of cases, that they don't take a major hit. If you keep OMIP in place and you have pre-existing conditions, say 6 months without care or treatment, then that cost will be borne by sharing it among all the carriers, and each individual carrier will know that they're not going to have to individually inflate or pad their own premiums, and so you can get cheaper premiums because they don't have to say, what if we get stuck with a pre-existing condition that's so huge that we're in serious trouble? And they know that in their underwriting, they don't have to worry about that for at least 6 months without care or treatment. And so it does spread it over all the carriers by keeping OMIP in the game plan.
Senator Bates.
I want to respond to what Mitch said, because I think Mitch has got a really important point. And I think it leads us back to the discussion of how important it is to have this entity. Mitch may be absolutely correct. There is not good evidence that people have moved to Oregon to take part in the Oregon Medicaid program, you know, the Oregon Health Plan. There's a lot of anecdotal stories, and it certainly has happened. People have come across the border, get a gallbladder out, and got home 2 days later and got off the plan. But they're just a fraction of the actual cost of the program. The entity needs to have an opportunity and a mechanism, a safety valve, that says we are now seeing a huge influx of people here with pre-existing conditions just to get into this, or we're not, and it's not a problem. We can remain universal just the way we are. But I think we have to have that ability to do that. What's different about this is it's always been a Medicaid program that's been universal for us. If we really go where we're supposed to go here and we really have a universal program, truly universal program, we might have some people coming in because of that, or we might not. Who knows? But we have to have an entity that can take care of that problem for us, not every 18 months or 2 years we meet here and start passing bills and laws and try to straighten this thing out. We need an overall entity to help control that. I believe the insurers need to have something they can count on, something they can predict, it's predictable for them, and something they can go to say, we've got a problem, or we don't. So I Mitch, I think you're absolutely right what you said, and it may turn out just that way.
But actuarially, the point is actuarially, if we're covering 3.5 million people, let's say you could imagine 50,000 people flood in, and they have twice the propensity to consume health care as the other 3.5 million. It would be a blip in the total cost structure of the whole system. I mean, it might be certain people would get hurt by that, but once you're dealing with a risk pool of 3.5 million people, I mean, those folks coming in aren't going to have it. And the assumption is they're either going to be working and therefore are going to be paying their way, or they're going to be on Medicaid and we don't have any effect of dealing with
it. Or they have an individual mandate.
Or we have an individual mandate and they have to buy
what we'll call the new OMIP, maybe, whatever it is for the first 6 months or year. But again, I would go back to that cries out for an entity to manage that. What if it isn't a blip?
Yeah.
If it's bigger than a blip?
Yeah, it needs to be something we look at.
We need to be able to respond quickly. And we need to have people who can do actuarial work to figure that out.
So before we go to Senator Morris, let me see if I kind of captured three things I heard you say, which was, one, you want this entity to develop thoughtful recommendations about these issues and to carefully consider and study some of the options and to look at some of the, examine some of the realities, think about what some of the cost benefits are and maybe come up with some recommendations. You want them to have some authority to make some mid-course changes based on their continuing to monitor issues such as this, to be able to set in place a way of monitoring and an ability to make some mid-course change. Would that capture at a high level?
Yep.
And they need the resources. They need the ability to do that, not four people who discuss it for 20 minutes and come to a conclusion. That you want it to be thoughtful and well-reasoned and based on the best information available. Senator Morris.
Thank you. I think my question at this point is probably more rhetorical than anything else, given the flow of the discussion here. Citizenship is a lightning rod issue. And the question, and I think it's already been addressed, is the issue political or is it actually economics? If it's a political issue, then I'm not sure how we address that, save for maybe the process that you're talking about, that you actually demonstrate that it is de minimis in its impact. But on the front end of this thing, if the headline is, you know, undocumented workers are treated the same as documented workers, there is a political ramification to that.
So what you're saying is that may be one of the issues that you don't want the entity to deal with because it's a political question, and you may toss that back to a political body to make that decision. That's a wise move. Eligibility. Do you want it to be continuous? We talked about universal.
It has to be anything but continuous.
Well, so once you're in, you're in.
No, only if you remain a member of the population. If you assume you're covering the whole population.
So we can do away with such things as the things that Medicaid programs do about enrollment and re-enrollment and qualification and all of that and on and off and the same things around open enrollment around in businesses, etc. You want them to certainly develop a scheme so that it's not just universal but continuous is another piece of it. Yes? Or, you know,
how can it be universal and not continuous? I mean, you might have to do eligibility for certain subsidies. You might have to redo it for Medicaid because the federal government's getting a piece of. But the question is, if they weren't there, then they'd be in another category, right? And the finances might be different.
Well, but they are there. And I appreciate the direction Bruce is trying to take this in terms of, bottom line question is there a timeline to, you know, to eligibility? And I know in the commission draft, you know, we put it at 1 year. I don't know why that's really relevant. I mean, are you still an Oregon citizen? You know, I mean, you know, have you moved out of state? You lived here, were a bona fide eligible, and then you moved to Tennessee, and then you got sick, so we're coming, you know, you're going to come back. I mean, I know you're saying that's a blip on any radar screen. I think that's a key question in terms of how we administer, how this whole thing is administered. And I think there's a huge cost saving, particularly in the Medicaid, back to, you know, Ron, I like every waiver I can think of, Maurer. You know, I think that's something we should ask the federal government with regard to the Medicaid population, is extending that as far as we can get them to extend it. Because that's one area where I know eligibility requirements, you know, certainly will play a part at the federal level. And, you know, at the same time, you know, the trying to simplify the enrollment process by doing away with all the categoricals. If you're just below a certain FPL, you're in.
Senator Morissette, then Senator.
What about the people who are not below that line and are required to pay a premium that they think is unfair to them, and they decide not to participate in the program? Pardon me?
If you have mandatory individual coverage, you're not going
to let? Okay, they choose to go to the emergency room. Okay.
What do they want? They're going to be covered.
I'm sorry. Everybody, this is based on the fact that everyone is going to, who can afford to, will pay something. Right? If you are a paying member and choose not to pay.
But isn't the assumption we're talking about universal access, not partial access?
Well,
I mean, if that's the case, we're talking about everybody.
But I think what you're getting at, let me see, is you want to be certain that that there's no financial barriers to being a part of of this healthcare system.
Well, I'm looking at a person who might say, why should I pay anything? I can, you know, if other people have coverage, then I want the same kind of coverage and I don't want to have to pay. And so is there any, it's both. You know, we want to make sure everyone is covered, but some people have to pay their fair share and others.
And you're getting at is there some responsibility for those people who are eligible, whether that's some financial responsibility, some rules that they have to maintain, or is it purely universal, no matter what?
I mean, Medicare, senior citizens can decide they don't want to show anybody their Medicare card. They'd rather pay for it themselves, but they're not going to get out of the Medicare tax, and they're not going to get out of...
Okay, the young 20-something who is healthy and doesn't want to belong to a plan, as they many of them don't right now. Now, are they exempt or are they just out? And if they need care, they have to pay for it. Then I guess the model would include people who do not want to participate and they're self-sufficient and they will buy their own insurance or they will buy their care. I mean, they're so... I don't know how we, it's one thing to say it's universal, but it's another thing to say who is going to, is everybody going to have to pay something for it?
Yeah, that's what universal means. It means everybody.
Okay. Senator Biggs. And actually, we've got Senator Morris has one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you go first?
I'm taking just a little bit different direction. I suspect you're...
Well, something just dawned on me. I'm a little slow sometimes. It's only taken me 2 years to get here, so maybe I better get it out there while I'm still can remember it. Mitch, I think you opened up a thought in my mind that I had not really considered, because I'm so locked into thinking of the Medicaid program and matches and state money being involved in it. When we talk about a universal system, we're really talking about also the commercial system. And if you take pre-existing conditions out of it, why would you not want to have instant eligibility when you come to Oregon? Either be under a personal mandate to pay into it, or you'd be employed somewhere, and every employer is going to be putting something into it. Why would we not want instant eligibility, if, other than pre-existing conditions? Now, this is only taking me 2 years, so I'm working here, okay? Am I missing something?
And I don't think, I mean, I think we're talking about universal access. It means everybody's in it.
Yeah, and the only thing I have a caveat about is the pre-existing situation. But if the system's set up that everyone has to pay into it one way or the other, either as an individual or through their employment, am I missing something here? Dennis thinks I am.
Yeah, well, this, anyone want to respond to...
You want to go on that thread?
Yeah, let's keep this thread going.
And then I think what Senator Morissette said, and that is, it's easy to say universal access as long as you're talking about a government-funded single-payer system. But if you have people paying individually and some don't pay, then they just choose not to pay. So they get sick or something happens to them, they show up at the emergency room. Who's going to pay for that, and what's going to be the consequence for them doing that? If you can just get out of paying and still show up, then we haven't really fixed anything. And so I think there has to be a definition.
I'm making an assumption that there's an individual mandate in place that's got some teeth in it, that employer mandate has some teeth in it. If those are both in place, then it's a sort of a different concept for me. Other than pre-existing conditions, you're in day one.
That's fine.
And
the consequence... I haven't thought of it that way.
You don't want me to say what I'm going to say. You had the same epiphany about 6 months ago sitting in the commission hearing room. So I was always thinking of it that way. And a public announcement. Since Mary Beth isn't here to lead the charge to the pizza buffet, please...
She's out getting some pizza.
Please feel free. The consequence, Richard... Dennis, is, you know, if you have assets and a home and, you know, it's medical bankruptcy. That's the consequence. If you don't have some of those things, you know, you're of lower incomes, you know, you're already on Medicaid. That's the consequence.
Or you're in a private subsidized.
Yeah.
You're mandated and you don't have the ability to afford it, then... We have to find a way to subsidize that.
But you are talking about some degree of personal financial responsibility.
And I'm not talking about a government-run program, necessarily. I could imagine this being, if you have private health insurance that meets the qualifications, fine. Well, we might want to refinance how we help you pay for that, or we don't. But I don't sense that what they've been talking about is a totally government-run, single-payer model. Is it? That's not necessarily.
One of the things that I've been hearing recently are about the young, healthy people who are opting out of the health insurance programs, and they're narrowing the pool to the people who are unhealthy, and that's a loss to the pool. The young, healthy person who feels they're invincible and they don't need to pay money for health care, they're healthy. And that's what I'm talking about. Now, if it's a universal system, a single payer, everybody's covered regardless. If you have to sign up somehow for a program, then we may have people who will say, no, I don't want to sign up, and I'll take my chances. Now, what happens? Are they going to be charged? Are they going to have to forfeit their home, their car? Is there bankruptcy or whatever? I don't know what control you have over people who don't want to be covered.
Well, I think you have the responsibility of they don't get the benefit.
Emergency room benefit. Like the lady from Mexico who ran up $1 million bill and then was, yeah, I mean, you get in the emergency room, you may never get out of the hospital.
But you're talking about some degree of personal responsibility to be a part of it.
If you want to be a part of it.
Okay.
So you're going to want the board, Anthony, to deal with that. Senator Morse.
Thank you.
Representative Malamud.
And the reason I waited, because I've taken a different direction here. First thing that came to mind in this continuity of care and eligibility was that we have a lot of companies that work out of state and internationally. And what kind of program would we have for those employees that they may or may not, you know, they're in and out of the state, but they're, they consider themselves Oregonians, but they're off in some other area.
So, in terms of that, you want to think about this as some sort of continuity in and out?
Out of area coverage for employers, employees that, you know, they're Oregon companies. To me, that would be an important consideration.
Okay. So, and that's maybe not as much about eligibility, but it's about the benefit one gets when you leave the state. So it's something that needs to maybe be considered as part of the benefit package.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be certain that if you're eligible for coverage within Oregon and you leave the state, that you're going to be able to get health care outside of Oregon.
Representing a university in my district, believe me, we'll hear about this if we don't.
We have.
We have heard about it.
Yes. Representative Mauer.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate this point very well, but it seems to me that the issue of eligibility is not about your ability to access the system at the primary care level, because that door should be the open door. It's where the expense comes in is eligibility for hospitalizations and eligibility for specialty care and referrals, and maybe you have a division of eligibility that if you are going to go beyond primary care, that's when we determine eligibility based on Medicaid, based on what your insurance is. But the door is open for primary care and preventive care, because that way everybody's going to have the door or access to that initial step, because it's a whole lot cheaper to deal with your strep throat in the first week than it is in, you know, a couple weeks or a month down the road when we may have to hospitalize somebody. And the other point, or the other issue, is on the upper end, is that everybody in the state of Oregon is reinsured for something, say, $100,000 or $300,000 deductible, and these accountable health plans are battling it out in a competitive market about that issue, not about primary care, because everybody has access to it, but it's between the specialty care and the $100,000 or some appropriate level of insurance, and that's where you deal with the competitive market.
You're sort of getting to what maybe is an access issue. It's going to be access to sort of what services and how.
At a point beyond what is the capacity of a family practice or a general practitioner.
So you're getting at, we might have universal eligibility for one set of services, but maybe not for another?
Well, I'm hesitant to be very supportive of any system that opens the door open to anybody for any set of services. That somehow we have to have a system to gatekeep. But you have to decide where the cost-benefit ratio is for where you're going to set up that gate. And maybe the gate or the hurdle is more appropriate for the general practitioner, the family practice, the nurse practitioner to decide where we're going to put that gate up, as opposed to put the gate before you even get in the door.
It's one of those, as we've always said, all of this is very interrelated, that some of that is a sense of what's a benefit and a utilization piece,
as much as it is an eligibility piece, and we have to keep that in mind as we go back and revisit those pieces of the puzzle.
Bruce, you know, to add with what Ron has said, if a person is under 150% federal poverty level or 100% or whatever the number is, the benefits could be managed for them at the bottom end, and then as they get higher and higher, it could be actually means tested with subsidies that would diminish over time so that there's not this ceiling that you don't want to make enough because you'd lose. And it could even be in the form of like an HSA account where you contribute as you're making more money part of your own account, so that if you don't have anything, the account's there for you, so you have a family home, hopefully, and that kind of thing to get preventive care and initial care and chronic care. And then as you make more money, then you participate more yourself, and there can be tax incentives to benefit those that are earning and contributing toward it. And then the insurance marketplace picks up at some point. Maybe it's $2,000 to $200,000 or $500,000 or something like that, and we do provide a reinsurance for a high amount, whatever it is. But the marketplace then doesn't have to spend a huge amount of money for the front-end things that could be done in a managed care organization, and they don't have to spend so much in administration for the small things because that could be handled. Plus, the individual has a stake in it because if they could carry that forward and they're contributing toward it themselves, then you know there's benefit in them being careful how they're spending it because it's not just somebody else's money.
Let me give you a very concrete example. Flu vaccine. I mean, flu vaccine, in my opinion, should be available to anybody. I mean, there shouldn't be no gate. Currently, Medicare, if you're Medicare eligible, you walk in and, at least in our clinic, you get your flu shot and you walk out the door, there's nothing. We just write your name and your Medicare number on a list, and maybe a year and a half or 2 years later, I might get reimbursed for that because I'm still waiting to get reimbursed for stuff I did in 05. But the point is that it's a waste of administrative time and effort to gatekeep that kind of stuff. And why waste resources on that? It's the money is spent in hospitalizations. The money is spent in other treatments that are outside the purview of primary care.
Senator Bates.
I appreciate your comments, Dennis, and yours too. It leads me to the question in my mind of what the entity does and doesn't do, and how far sort of down the list the entity goes and doesn't go. Do we leave it up to the marketplace and accountable health plans to battle these things out, or do we want the entity to say something of this nature? We want all the health plans to offer primary care as a covered service. Anything above that, you have to use your HSA for, and we want all the accountable health plans to offer an HSA, because one of our issues has been, how do you get the patient to get more skin in the game? How do you get them to get into this thing? Copays help. Other things help. Okay, but an HSA requirement, mandate for each HAP, that's the kind of things we want to talk about. Not how big it is or what size it is, but that maybe it's a requirement. And maybe we can simplify the system by doing that and let the insurers battle it out on a little more level playing field that we all understand. It goes right into transparency, too. But the real question for me in this conversation is not that these aren't great ideas, but how do you get that to be universal across the plans? I think it cries out again for an entity, but how far down does that entity go without just getting too far into it and allowing competition to still occur? Most, you know, I think there's a room for push and shove there, and that entity should come back and tell us what they think it is.
So I hear you saying we're getting back to the themes of whatever eligibility you want there to be some continuity. That's what Representative Richardson was talking about. As your circumstances change, financial or health-wise or whatever, you want there to be this to be continuous. But at the same time, you want there to be, use the word HSA, contributions. I mean, that's sort of some of the details and jargon that we all have different senses of what that means, but what you were talking about is some degree of personal responsibility, and that you don't want that personal responsibility to, you want it to be incented appropriately,
right,
so that it is continuous. And then Bauer got at another important concept, which I think was the concept of, and no matter what you do about all of this, it needs to be efficient, that don't design systems around continuity and responsibility that sound great, but then become very difficult and unwieldy, both to those who deliver care as well as those who receive it. So you could lay out some real instructions about, here's what we want you to come back with. Is that Senator Moore sent, and then Representative Friedman?
The very first question that I had about this system had to do with public employee groups, those who have worked very hard to get a benefits package and who are happy with their benefits package. They have worked out a deal with their employers, and they're happy. Now, I understand that the benefit package that is in existence today may not be affordable in the future, and that's one of the things that the arguments in favor of this plan. Will public employee groups, for instance, and we are talking about creating a very large public employee group of school employees now, and they will have great bargaining power with whatever insurance company they decide to go with. I understand the idea of, at some point, they will have to pay their premiums and they will have to buy up if they want more, but I guess I'm still wondering how that super board is going to be dealing with some of these entities that have a great insurance coverage and how they are folded in over time.
This gets at the universality question. And is it sort of mandatory? Mitch might say, well, that's what we mean by universal. There's no question there.
No, actually, I wouldn't say that in this case. I mean, I would say, if you have great health insurance and you have a scheme for doing it and you're covered, you as an employer, you as anyone else, you as a union, great, that's fine, you're covered. You're in. And we might want to make some, I don't know what you want to do, deal with the tax benefits of the rich plan versus the poor, but I don't see this as a universal mandatory government system.
I guess what I'm thinking about is, then you have a whole bunch of purchasing pools as we have now. You have big purchasing pools, little purchasing pools. It seems to me we need a purchasing pool to make it effective. A purchasing pool.
And the transition from
pretty good purchasing pools to excellent purchasing pools to a mediocre big purchasing pool and lots of buy-up may be a hard sell. I don't know how you would instruct the board to look at that. I guess that's it.
Senator Bates.
Two answers to this question. First one is that you can think of this as a buy-up program. If you happen to have benefits that are already great and you want to keep those, you can buy them up as long as your employer is willing to pay for those. And your employer in this case is the state. Remember, the state is not going to directly take care of these people on their health care. They're going to go to an accountable health plan. They're going to go out and go to Kaiser or Blue Cross Blue Shield or whatever ones want to bid for that business in this new pool. And so you're looking at the same kind of system we've got already, and if the employee and employer have come together on a decision of how much that's going to cost, how much they're willing to spend, and what they can get for that money, that's their business. Okay, as long as they have a benefit that's not cost-shifting, which they obviously are not in this case and probably never would, but it doesn't change what we're doing for universality. They're in, they're covered, they've got the same benefits, and they can continue to have those benefits as long as they can get their employer, the state, to pay for them. So I would offer that's not a change. One thing that does concern me about this pool, and I don't want to get off this too far, the ability should be able to move in and out of that pool every year, because that's the basis of this plan. You have accountable health plans competing for business from employers or individuals. They've got to be able to move somehow, or there's no competition. They've got to be able to move, have a right to move between plants. You can't be locked in forever.
So you want to put a little asterisk on the continuous side.
Yeah.
You want continuous eligibility, but that doesn't, you want some choice in how you exercise that. Representative Greenlee, you want to respond to that?
No, I want to respond to the statement before that. That's what I had raised my hand about, if I
might respond to that statement.
Let's go to the one before, and then we'll become current.
I'm still trying to put my head around the skin in the game idea. And we did a bunch of research on motivation, what causes utilization, and we divided medical care up into those things that were basically completely determined by the physician, those things that were basically completely determined by the patient, and those things that had interactions between those two. For example, it would seem odd to me to have skin in the game to decide whether you got hospitalized or didn't get hospitalized. I mean, that, I suppose the patient has some little bit in that, but basically I can't come in and say to my doctor, I'd like you to remove my appendix, please, because I've carried it around too long and it's now time to get rid of it. So would you please admit me to the hospital and take my appendix out? Well, I guess you have that with a Munchausen, but you don't have that usually. And I don't know why I'd want skin in the game for that kind of decision. I don't know why I'd want skin in the game for the decision about whether to have an MRI or not to have an MRI. It seems to me that's a physician decision that ought to be made by physicians, and we ought to create an environment where it can be made by physicians. Now, whether I get a generic prescription or a brand name prescription, that I probably do have some role, and I would have skin in the game. And whether I, interestingly, Representative Maurer suggests that there ought to be an open door for primary care, but the fact is, that's one thing that as a patient I have some control over or not. I mean, it seems to me that might be some place where I would want skin in the game, where I would want people to have skin in the game so they're not driving primary care physicians crazy when they're not needed. So, I mean, it's interesting how you would create a skin in the game model that motivated people to affect behavior they can really affect, but didn't penalize them for decisions that they basically had no choice in making. And I mean, I think skin in the game makes some sense. It needs to be really carefully structured, doesn't it?
Comment on that? Skin in the game is about practicing defensive medicine. It's about saying to your physician, my shoulder really hurts and I want an MRI, when an MRI is not indicated.
And I'm a physician. MRI is not indicated. And I need to protect the physician who's making that statement.
Thank you very much. And if we can get there, that would be a huge leap in this whole debate.
Let's hold that thought, because we're talking about
that at the same time.
Personal responsibility in a couple of different ways. Tonight we were talking about eligibility. This is starting to get into the overlaps between utilization, benefits, quality, all of those things. And I think personal responsibility, what you're saying is, needs to be carefully thought out across all of those arenas. Senator Morse.
There's an elephant in the room we haven't addressed, and we have peripherally, but we really haven't spent time on it. And whatever we design has to have the best chance of succeeding sustainable, which means that we have to find some way to stem this rising cost trajectory. And if we're talking about some in, some out, my concept of the accountable health plan was it becomes the floor, it becomes the base, it becomes the model that is applied universally across all plans. And if people want something different, if an employer wants something different, then the market provides that. But that plan has to have the best chance of succeeding in containing costs. And, you know, we've talked about the managed care, that that's a basically a managed care kind of model. And that's really the elephant in the room and that threshold. It's not on our list here. It probably should be that we need to talk about.
So, Senator Montesano.
Yeah, just to follow up on that point, I agree that the full emphasis on designing this plan is to have it sustainable, but having someone, we're talking about eligibility, we talked about benefits, what, the last time around, but I see this entity looking at tying eligibility to a certain basic core services, and then each individual or employer can buy up.
So, I think what both of you are saying is that in considering eligibility, you want to be certain that it doesn't adversely affect the sustainability. I think that was actually where Senator Bates started in a bit, by talking about pre-existing conditions and individuals that might be very costly to some system or might come in from out of state, that whatever eligibility there is has to be considered in the framework of being certain that this remains economically stable and sustainable. Is that?
But it seems in conflict, I think, with what Representative Greenleaf is saying regarding, see, I feel you, of course, now we're getting away from eligibility again. Utilization is, to me, overused, and we have to provide incentives.
Well, it's going to be another place we're going to have to deal with that concept. So, I mean, I think it's related. Representative Greenleaf.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree with what you just said, Senator Monis Anderson. The real question is, what's a core service?
Mm-hmm.
And we think about primary care, chronic disease care, and prevention as a core service, but I can't imagine a health insurance benefit that doesn't include hospitalization, because that's where the insurance side of it comes in. And the interesting thing about hospitalization is, I remember when Kaiser, about 100 years ago, switched from mostly their contracts being 30-day hospitalization to 365-day hospitalization, and the fact is it had virtually no cost consequence, virtually none in a population that was large enough, because it's really rare that anybody stays in the hospital more than 30 days nowadays. I mean, it's really rare. So, okay, when we're thinking about a core benefit, could you imagine that I would want health insurance that didn't cover hospitalization? I mean, I would leave myself open for $50,000 for 8 days, as it was a few weeks ago for me. I mean, that's certainly got to be a core benefit, wouldn't it? Now, when you start asking about what's a core benefit, you talk about people with chronic disease. A lot of times you're talking about people with secondary and tertiary care if they have chronic disease. I mean, I absolutely agree that we need to be talking, and we didn't do very well talking about the benefit package the other day. We're back in that conversation again. But I think the notion is you want universality for a core benefit package. But then the question is, what's a core benefit package?
Senator Bates.
I need a quick process check here. I'm thinking of, you know, a few days now going down that LC is now available, as the co-chair said, we can start talking to them again. We've basically been off limits because of what they've been doing. I want to make sure I heard committee members kind of roughly correctly here. One, that we want to give to the entity some broad instructions on what eligibility is. Those broad instructions might well be instant eligibility with a consideration of pre-existing conditions, and that we might want to have some kind of a statement about non-citizens going to safety net clinics, but that this is a political decision and a difficult one for us to make at this point, and it certainly shouldn't be settled by this entity. And that's, in very broad sense, what I've heard tonight as far as eligibility. The other question we had came up tonight was, eligible to what? And if you go back to our basic principles, it says health services. And so that question naturally came up when we talked about eligibility. Eligibility to what health services? But I'm not taking that away tonight. I'm just going to take tonight away what I think I heard about eligibility, but not to which services. And I want to make sure that I heard that correctly and nobody feels like they have not been heard in this issue. Now, if I got the right sideboards on this, the right caveats on this.
There's no head nodding either way. There's head nodding yes.
Yeah, no, I think that's...
Did I hear it right?
I think that's pretty right.
Okay.
I've got a couple of... Maybe, couple of nuts and bolts type of comments in terms of what should the entity be responsible for in terms of ensuring access and eligibility. One is they ought to have a responsibility of designing an outreach plan to make all citizens, residents, aware of what the plan is and how they enroll, whether it's at a medical home or an AHP or primary care provider. And then, oh God, I wish Senator Morissette was here to say this.
Rural.
Hear this. Part of this has got to be geographic specific. Will everyone testify that
you heard Senator
Morissette rural and geographic specific?
A lot of head nodding.
We need an inventory of resources.
Yes. part of that is, I think, a key component. Not only in and. I kind of want to underscore Mitch's humorous remark. They've got to know what those are. How do we ensure universality?
Well, I think what you're getting at, seeing as it's 6:25, is perhaps beginning to get us to the next piece, which was on our list, which was eligibility and access. And a lot of the issues around assuring geographic access to services, looking at being certain the information is there for people, being certain there's the appropriate outreach. So let's hold that, and seeing as it's 6:25, see if we can't sum up, which I think Senator Bates probably did a good job already, but we can reiterate that one, in terms of eligibility, to consider carefully issues around pre-existing conditions, issues around state residency, wanting to be certain that we talk about universal eligibility, but still to be determined is to some sort of a core benefit to what? That there needs to be some degree of personal responsibility. Yet to be defined, that the issue about the mandatory nature needs to be defined as well, that whatever is discussed around eligibility needs to be certain that it's economically viable and sustainable, that there needs to be an efficient way of doing this, so that it doesn't create additional red tape, et cetera. Needs to be careful attention to issues around out-of-state coverage. Does that get it? Just about most of the things we talked about? Rick's been writing them down. They're all...
Regarding whether we're talking about eligibility or finances or benefits, we also have to have an entity that is tracking the transparency. Or did you cover that when I wasn't here?
We had that. You wanted this entity to
monitor. You got it.
You wanted them to monitor
that's
what was going on, as well as have some authorities to make some mid-course corrections as they develop these recommendations around residencies, pre-existing conditions, etc. So I think we got that. Other things you want to be certain are there.
Right. Just to clarify, the personal responsibility, is that like how the person becomes committed into the plan or to the plan in the long term, or is that more just that they have the skin in the game, or is it both?
I think it was both, but I think more primarily it was about having some personal financial responsibility in some way at some levels, and the ability to be certain that you had a system flexible enough to accommodate changes in it. That's what I think I heard. Is that the personal responsibility piece?
I think that, you know, what we all struggle with as we go through this is so much of this, you know, blushes over into other categories, and we're, you know, trying to segment these, which is good, so we can shine the bright light on certain big categories. As you described that, Bruce, I do think that's a good summation, but, you know, for me, that kind of goes over into
benefits and how you're going to benefits and payment.
Financing.
Absolutely. I think personal responsibility is going to be a theme that keeps going. There's responsibilities of the individuals and responsibilities of the system. And that's what you're going to be looking at this entity to clearly define.
I see some issues of the individual mandate around that responsibility.
Yeah. And those are that's what this entity is going to have to develop. So, 6/28. Access next week. No.
Wednesday.
2 days, 48 hours.
It seems like it sometimes.
Yeah, and unless you'd like to change direction or you want to move ahead with access.
Well, the other one was transparency of the big three. What's the committee's pleasure?
Access. First, transparency. Sum that up.
Anderson has spoken. It's access. That's all I need to hear.
Access to services.
At the beginnings of outlining some of the questions. Well, great. So, Wednesday night, 5 o'clock, access. Thank you all.
And also, by way of general announcement, I know many of you in the audience are desperate to testify. We're certainly going to open this up. What we're trying to do, for those of you who have been in attendance for all the meetings, which is probably most of you, is we've established the concept of the entity. Now we're just going through a couple of categories as to what that entity will be responsible for. Once we get through, you know, two or three, four more of these, we will then open this thing up and you know, have all the heartfelt, passionate testimony we know is out there. This needs to be a very inclusive process. So anyway, we continue to thank you for your continued attendance and involvement in all this. I know, you know, you're always catching all the committee members and Senator Bates and myself in the hall. We're happy to talk about this any time. So anyway, thank you. All of you from here. We are adjourned.